I think dentistry has its ups and downs, and you need peer support. You need that senior person that you can get on the phone to and say, look, I've had a day, this is what's happened. And they're going to say, look, you'll laugh about this a month from now, blah, blah, blah.
Welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm David Keir, and this episode, we have a laugh with Dr. Derek Mahoney. Derek is someone that most of us know in the dental community. He's someone who will speak his mind, he'll tell it how it is, and he's now in the process of getting research behind a lot of what he's been speaking of for many, many years. Derek runs 6 specialist orthodontic practices. He's busy with patients, but he also teaches prolifically around the world. His courses are run through EODO, that's Excellence in Orthodontics and Dentofacial Orthopedics. He teaches over 100 people every single year through his residency. But as well as that, he loves wine, he loves a laugh, he's a really great guy to chat with. So I appreciate him sharing his time, sharing his story, and a bunch of information for graduates. We talk about a whole bunch of things here. We talk about a whole lot in this episode, his university days and how he almost went in another direction. We talk about a Brazilian woman that changed his life, how he found his way into orthodontics, and in particular, how he found his way into airway and facial profile orientated orthodontics, which is what he talks about and what he teaches about most. He talks about the problem with boring lectures and why he has such a passion to teach and what brought him into the education field. We talk about that he did stand-up comedy for a little bit. We talk about his time in the media with 60 Minutes and how that changed his life, and it really polarized some people in the dental community, and it really was a formative thing in his early orthodontic career. Derek gives a lot of tips and information for graduates and young dentists around orthodontics. We talk about clear aligners, we talk about mistakes, and we talk about the future of dentistry as well. He shares a few books, a few important papers that are worth looking at, which are all in the show notes. And we also talk about, interestingly, his love of wine, which was something I had no idea about. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this conversation with Dr. Derek Mahoney. Now, after this chat with Dr. Derek Mahoney, we have the Prime Head Start segment. This episode, we're talking with Patrick Moberger. Now, we all make mistakes, and often we do it because we don't realize we're making them. With Patrick, we talk about the 3 mistakes dentists unwittingly make. One of my favorite sayings, as you've heard me say before, is we don't know what we don't know. And listening to something like this about 3 key mistakes dentists often make will help highlight them for you and help you avoid making those mistakes as well. And thank you to BOQ Specialists for their support of the podcast. They help us donate for every listen to this podcast. We donate water, and for every share of any of our content, we donate dental hygiene to someone in need in a third world country. So thank you, BOQ Specialists. So for now, follow us on Facebook at Dental Head Start, Instagram at Dental Head Start. Enjoy the episode. Being a student is pretty tough. The stresses of exams, patient care, and everyday life is enough without having financial pressures as well. BOQ Specialist recognizes this. They offer a student banking package if you're in your last 2 years of dentistry. It's a pretty good package. Actually, I used it myself. They recognize that you don't have much of an income now, but that may change. The student banking package includes a credit card and an overdraft on your account. Payments toward the overdraft aren't required until the 1st of July, the year after you graduate. Now, I'm not recommending you go out and spend this money on anything, but if you need to buy loops or if you need to get through the final year of study, they really do have your back. I know I struggled in the last year financially and it helped me. So thank you, BOQ Specialist, for supporting me in my final year and for supporting the Dental Head Start podcast. Terms and conditions apply. See boqspecialist.com.au for more details. Thank you for joining us today, Derek. How are you?
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
It's a real honor to talk with someone like yourself. You've had a big impact on the dental community over the last 20 plus years. And I want to ask you a question that I think a lot of dentists do ponder and do think about, and a lot of orthodontists probably think about. What place do general dentists have in regards to orthodontics?
I think the general dentist has a very important role in diagnosis and treatment planning, because they're going to see the patient for the first time. It's as an orthodontist,
I'm at the mercy of the referring dentist as to when the patient comes in. So if I can educate dentists on what is the best time to seek an opinion for their patient, it's a win-win for everybody. I think what happens in orthodontics, more so than in any other field of dentistry, there's a turf war. Some orthodontists, I'm not saying all of them, but some orthodontists feel that a general dentist should not be doing any orthodontics. And that's in direct contrast to what we're taught in dental school. We are taught orthodontics, and when we graduate, our scope of practice allows us to practice orthodontics. And if you're a general dentist doing endodontics and things go wrong, an endodontist is there to help you because that's what they do. But oral surgeon, if you take out a wisdom tooth that maybe was a bit tougher than you thought, they're there to bail you out. But if something goes wrong, if you're a general dentist doing ortho, you might as well bring out the KY jelly. You know what I mean? It's, and I think that's what you want to call it: mafia tactics. You want to call it a protection racket. I don't know what word you want to use, but it actually scares a lot of generous dentists. I mean, I was speaking to some friend of mine who I went to school with, right? And they don't touch orthodontics because when we went through a 5-year program, we had one lecture in orthodontics, one lecture. So, of course, you're not going to feel confident doing that. And that's why I guess I set up the ODO. I wanted to learn orthodontics myself when I graduated. And I just found that there was no one offering a comprehensive program. And the little courses that were available were really actually designed to scare you into not doing any orthodontics. I'm not kidding. Imagine doing an orthodontic course where you pay money, you go and you enroll, and you leave there thinking, oh, my God, I don't think I want to do orthodontics because all that can go wrong, and I think I'll just refer everyone to an orthodontist. And that's the purpose of, that's what the purpose of those courses were. I'm not kidding. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's the field's starting to change, and I think from my personal view, I'm not very experienced with orthodontics, but at the same time, it's the only discipline where even the most simple stuff seemed in the past to be expected to be referred, and I don't even understand how the orthodontist had enough time to treat all the patients out there. There's so much I want to touch on that, and we're going to get into a lot of it, but I want to take a big step back. Let's learn a bit about you, Derek. How did you get to where you are? Where did you grow up? How did you get into dentistry?
Yeah, look, I came from a family background, early immigrants to the country. They had an unbelievable work ethic. They moved to Australia to give their kids a better opportunity. So, I was always, my mum was a school teacher. And I was the youngest of two. My mum wanted to get back to work. I was 3 years old, and she made a deal with the school principal because back then they were desperate for teachers in the Catholic education system. So she said, look, if my son can start kindy earlier than most people and he can just repeat 2 years, And as it turned out, I did pretty well. And so, I was in year two, I guess, by five or something. I was always like 2 years ahead of everyone, which was weird in dental school because in dental school, I always remember, it was about the time everyone was having a 21st birthday party. And I actually turned 21. I turned 21 after I graduated from dental school. It was like really weird.
Right. So you graduated at 20?
Yeah. 20, I think it was the year of my 21st.
Wow. That must have been one of the youngest. So you think you're, so where did they immigrate from? And do you think that was a big influence on your work ethic? Because you work a lot. You do amazing things and you're extremely successful. Do you think that was a big influence for you?
100%. My dad was with the British infrastructure when they moved to India. He was an engineer, so he was employed by a British company in India. They emigrated then when the British buggered off from India because all of a sudden I know long history there, but I know when the British were in India, of course, people with anglicized surnames obviously got the best jobs. The reverse happened when India got its independence. And so my parents could see the writing on the wall as far as, the future for their two kids. And so we moved to, there's a choice of Australia or Canada. And for whatever reason, they chose Australia, and then the rest is sort of history. But I always remember I didn't know what I wanted to do even during HSC. So I think I kind of saw what marks I got and then decided on that. I missed out by medicine by one mark. I remember back then it was out of 500, and I can't remember what mark I got, but I was always one short of medical school. And I kind of like went to dental school sort of hoping that after 1 year I'd bloody transfer to med. That was my ambition. And then I met some really good people in dental school, and I actually was enjoying it. I thought, stuff it. I don't want to have to go back. And so I went through, and I was never a good dentist, I might add. I didn't really enjoy dentistry. It was sort of like my second choice anyway. And then when I got into the field of orthodontics, I realized how closely it's related to medicine. And I think what I teach with airway, with early growth guidance, it's like being an oral physician. And that's what I love about my industry. I honestly was about to call it a day when I graduated from dental school. I didn't have any ambition to continue to be a dentist. I thought I'd try something else. I actually took a year off, traveled around the world. Believe it or not, I did part-time stand-up comedian, and I did pretty well out of that.
That's awesome. Do you do a little bit of that when you're teaching with EODO? Do you do a little bit of stand-up at the end or something?
Exactly. And look, in fact, a lot of people say, if you interview people who've come to my lectures, one thing that will come across is, look, he delivers it with a lot of humor. And I think that's that sort of, and because if you look, I've done all the classical courses in learning how to teach, you know, I've done, and how to speak. I've done all of Toastmasters from, you know, when I was a kid. My parents put me in at like year one into Toastmasters. Yeah. And I went right through to the highest level. I did Dale Carnegie Institute. So I've never been scared to speak in front of an audience. And of course, the more you know your topic, the more you can come across. But I always remember being in dental school, and probably one of the reasons that put me off dentistry, I have probably some of the most boring teachers in dental. Like seriously, absolutely, seriously boring. And those in my year, if any of them are listening, would know. I'm not gonna mention names, but I'm pretty sure they know who I'm talking about. And they were the classic academics, you know. Their life was to research, and it was just a pain in the ass for them to have to teach, but it was part of their ability to get tenure, right? And so they went about teaching with this sort of, oh, my God, I don't really want to be here attitude. And it just, you know, when I teach, I encourage questions. I interact. I learn as much from my students, I think, with the questions they ask me. But it's not... you know, the gospel according to Mahoney when I teach. Whereas in dental school, it's very much like that. In dental school, and unfortunately, the reason a lot of dentists are probably not the nicest people in the world, particularly in my era, is because the way they were taught was by being belittled. I'm not kidding. You weren't encouraged to have individual thought. You were made to feel like a piece of shit when you're a dental student, and that you were just lucky to be there. It was a really unhealthy environment, you know, and two things. A, when I graduated and I found it hard to learn orthodontics, I thought one day when I do this properly and I become an orthodontist, I'm going to open my doors to anyone who wants to learn, and I'm going to deliver it with some humor and some compassion and a bit of, look, I really want you to do well. I'm here to teach you because I want you to be successful, and I want you to enjoy this field with as much passion as I like. And that's always been my credo. So I think that's why EODO has done so well, I mean, in the story.
Yeah, there's no doubt that was a big issue in the past, and there was some of that when I went through. I think the culture is changing slightly, but of course many people are in the university field for the research, not for the teaching, and the teaching is the hurdle, unfortunately, which is sad because passionate teachers inspire great students, and I think that's a really important thing. So early career, you were struggling a little bit. How did you find your feet again? Why did you not leave dentistry?
Look, I just, you know, when you get to unfortunately, the way our dental school was, you didn't really even see a patient until end of year three. When I say a patient, it was like a half dead patient. It was like a denture was your first thing in year three. So you imagine. You have this expectation, right, I'm going to be a dentist. What do dentists do? And then we had the repetition in year one of bloody high school science-type subject. And, you know, and dental technology. And I just found that I was being trained to be a lab rat, to be honest with you, right? There was no thinking outside the box. Now, obviously, things have changed. I hope it has. But I would have liked to have a program where from day one you had problem-based learning, where you actually saw patients and you put together, well, what's wrong with this patient? How can I help that patient? But we were taught classically old school. You know, year one, you had to just parrot learn the bloody Krebs cycle, whether you understood what it did or not. You had to learn every muscle in swallowing, even though we had no clue why we were learning that. It was just one of those things, right? And then clinical became a bit interesting. I like year four. Year four was good because you actually started doing operative dentistry and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you felt you were doing something. But then when I graduated, I just thought, oh, man, dentistry, really? I don't know.
How did you find ortho? Like, how did you find yourself in ortho? Sorry.
Well, in that year off when I was traveling around, I ended up in Brazil and I met a beautiful Brazilian girl who was studying ortho. She was a, you know, it's like you wouldn't even, you'd almost bloody, you could write a movie script out of this, you know. So I'm in Brazil. I'm what, 21? It's like being a kid in a candy store, you know, most beautiful women. To this day, I would still say the most beautiful women in the world is in Brazil. They must have some law that they don't tell people that if you're born ugly, you're killed at birth or something like that. And you wouldn't believe it. The first girl I meet in a bar on the beach, I ask her, what do you do? And she says, look, I'm studying to be an orthodontist. I thought, oh, my God, is this wow. Fate? I said, well, I'm actually, just graduated from dental school. And, tell me about orthodontics because I know nothing. I was in Brazil for 4 months. I got a job as a travel guide, you know, because hardly anyone could speak English. And I loved Rio. And during that time, I developed a relationship with this woman. Truth be known, I probably should have married her. You know, that's a different story. don't ask me about that side of my life. I don't want to turn people off.
we don't have enough time, perhaps.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's funny how fate takes you through that path and you meet someone that in the other side of the world. I want to actually touch on your travel just quickly. Do you recommend that to, say, the students or perhaps the people who are pre-dentistry, if they ever listen to this? I traveled between my undergraduate and postgraduate course and it was the best thing I ever did. Would you say the same?
100%. Look, traveling meaning not doing like a Kentucky tour where you get hammered for... but actually assimilating in a culture. My parents' graduation present to me was a world ticket, after I graduated. But the deal was I was supposed to, I think we used to finish in sort of October and you couldn't get registered till January, the way the dental council used to work back then. So I had 3 months off, you know, and the 3 months ended up becoming a year because I just wasn't ready to start. Yeah. But as I said, the good thing about it is I met someone who really loved her profession. And the good thing about Brazil when it came to orthodontics, they were teaching airway, early treatment, treating kids, not all the stuff I do now, I learned in Brazil. When I actually decided to become a real orthodontist, I went to London, but ultimately I was really disappointed because what they taught me is how to straighten teeth and, nothing on what I learned in Brazil, which really ignited my passion. And if you ever meet a Brazilian orthodontist, man, they're just an akin because they get the whole growth and development side of things because in Brazil, it's almost like 2 degrees. There's a degree in dentofacial orthopedics and there's a degree in orthodontics. And most of those young orthodontists do both degrees. It's like a dual combined degree. So they come out with a very good level of knowledge when to treat, how to treat, And they don't just limit their treatment to teenagers with braces, which is what I love, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting, that influence. It sounds like that maybe had a role on what you even called your education company. I was going to ask you, so your influences after training, so specialist training in the UK, it didn't quite meet what you were hoping to get. You've done so much after that. Can you tell us about, one, your training originally, and then the other postgraduate things, many societies, Royal College of Surgeons England, all the rest of it. Can you tell us about all these different things and what benefit they've given you, what you recommend, et cetera?
Look, so when I decided to become an orthodontist, I looked around to which programs were where, what was on offer, and I really didn't want to study in Australia, not because I thought Australian universities were bad or whatever. I had that travel bug, and I said, look, stuff this. So where else could I learn where my degree would be recognized? You know, I couldn't go to the US because back then we had no – now there's a Canadian reciprocality, but back then it was only UK. So I had to choose UK. It was either, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, or, you know, England. And so I applied to a lot of schools, and I got into a very prestigious college, Eastman Dental Hospital. They only do postgrads. There's Eastmans all around the world, Rochester, New York, etc. And look, I got a good education. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to badmouth my education. But what I'd signed up for was hopefully to learn what I was seeing in Brazil. But what I got was what every orthodontist got, which is just, this is how you put braces on. This is how you change wires. And at the end of the day, the ultimate goal in life is to get everyone with straight teeth with what back then was called angle six keys, you know? So I felt a little bit thick. But in my last year of orthodontic school, we had the ability to do a research project. And I was just really lucky. And again, maybe I don't know whether, you know, love leads to success or whatever, but I met a girl in London who was Swedish, and I went to Sweden quite a few times, and I thought, wow, that's another amazing country. And then because I had 4 months to do sort of research, I went to Sweden, and I was able to meet and study under Linda Aronson, who was in Karolinska Institute, and he taught me everything about airway. And it was like going back to what I was seeing they were taught in Brazil. Because remember, Brazil is very much influenced by the European education, not the American education. Whereas I felt in Australia, when orthodontics at least, it was very much the American sort of stuff that was being taught. So under Linda Aronson, the pieces started fitting together. I did a research with him, and it was published in the Australian Orthodontic Journal, where I looked at children who were mouth breathers and compared it to children who were nasal breathers. And we looked at facial changes, and it clearly showed that better-looking faces occurred if the kid could learn to breathe through their nose rather than their mouth. And this is a very good paper. And it, and I thought, wow, this is really what I want to do. So, of course, you know, I graduate, I get the bit of paper. It's automatically recognized in Australia. So before you know it, I'm a specialist orthodontist, right? So I come home, and I had two choices. I could either work for someone or set up my own practice. So I didn't have the money to set up my own practice, so I decided I'd work for someone. But then, you know, everyone I worked for was doing the same old, which was just back then headgear, lots of extractions, straightening teeth, not treating in mixed fish. And I thought, stuff this. I've taken the time to learn a new alternative. I'm just going to take a real, risk. And, you know, there's two things you never did in Sydney if you're going to be an orthodontist. Number one, you didn't train outside of Sydney, okay? It's a bit of a nepotism-type deal. Number two, you never, ever set up your own practice. You always bloody bought in to an established orthodontist, and it was the old boys' club repeated, you know? I said, no, I want to do what I want to do. I wasn't busy initially, and what I ended up doing, which is knocking on people's doors and say, hey, I know there's 100 orthodontists, but, you know, I want to see kids 7 to 8 years old. I want to look at their airway. And, you know, this appealed to dentists. They go, man, this is great. We've been looking like someone like you. And parents loved it. So all of a sudden, a squat practice grew within a year into a massive 5 days a week concern. I had a couple of associates working for me, and you know, before you know it, we just did. Now I'm what it's 25 years in restricted practice, 30 years from when I graduated. I have 6 locations. We have 20 full-time associates, and it's still based on that premise. Get in early. I look more holistically at kids' problems. I've just got all the data for my PhD. I looked at kids over the last 15 years who were referred to me for crowded teeth and who I looked at their airway rather than just their teeth. We did sleep studies. We found a 90% correlation between airway problems in kids and their orthodontic. So that's really, when that finally gets published, I think that should be a real wake-up call. And I'm so glad to say that it's not just me. I'm not the lone voice in the wilderness. The American Orthodontic Association this year released a white paper on airway and orthodontics. And it's exactly the stuff that I've been talking about. And if anyone listening wants a copy of that, I'm happy to release my email to them. And that's a good start. Read that paper. This is a powerful specialist orthodontic group that is progressive and is saying, hey, we need to look at more than teeth. And let me tell you, if your practice is only based on straightening teeth, you know what? You're going to struggle. Smile Direct Club is going to do the straightening of teeth. I hate to say that. After spending 3 years and a lot of money to become a specialist, you know, if you just want to line up teeth, guess what? My biggest competitor is not the orthodontist down the road. My biggest competitor is not the general dentist who decides to do orthodontics. My biggest competitor is Smile Direct Club, no doubt about it. But thank God for me, I'm not going to be affected by that market because the people who refer to me for what I do, and they know that it's because of the airway, the early treatment, the expansion. So I'm a little bit recession-proof in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be the first one to get that paper off you, actually, and I'm really looking forward to hearing about your research, that PhD that will come out soon. You talked about the pieces starting to come together when you're in Sweden, Brazil, other areas, and you've elaborated a little bit. Tell us a bit more about those pieces of the puzzle, particularly the airway puzzle, extraction cases, et cetera, that students and graduates need to hear about.
Yeah, well, look, initially I was doing exactly what I was taught in orthodontic school, right? Other than maybe with a bit more emphasis on early intervention, right? And then I met a guy in my travels called John Mew. And John was very old school English, was trained in a very classical program like me, but he had decided to not take teeth out anymore because he felt it was damaging the facial profile. And I went back and I looked at all those cases, I extracted teeth, and they look okay when I'd finished. But, you know, I was now 5 years, 6 years into private practice, and I was looking at these kids that were coming for retainer checks 5, 6 years later, and he was absolutely right. You know, I was seeing flattening of their face. I was asking questions like, about their airway. And I finally realized, oh, my God, you know, this guy has it right. And so I went back and I studied under him for a technique called orthotropics, which is basically developing the palate and moving the lower jaw forward to give the kid a better profile. Back then, no one really knew too much about airway, but I can tell you now, a good profile is a good airway. So it's kind of win-win, you know? So if you have a kid who's got a good-looking face, has nice broad jaws, has the maxilla and mandible where they should be, of course they're going to sleep well, of course they're going to breathe better. So, you know, and, you know, my swan song, which pissed off a lot of my profession, I can tell you, was when I was interviewed on 60 Minutes, okay? But, you know, what I was really passionate about just telling the public that there is another way. I wasn't trying to bloody, create but you can speak to the producer at 60 Minutes and ask them, to this day, of all the bloody programs 60 Minutes did, that's the one that gets the most views. Now, I think I'm pretty proud of that. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But let me tell you, it was like a nail in the coffin as far as my peers were concerned. They thought, what the fuck? You know, like this guy is a maverick. And, you know, I never received so much hate mail in my life. And it really quite you know, I went to a couple of orthodontic meetings after that 60 minutes, and I thought people should say, hey, this is at least generating interest for people to. I almost was threatened with physical bloody violence after that. Seriously. And if anyone's not watched that episode, please watch it, because make your own mind up, right? And all I was talking about was that there is an alternative. And although straightening teeth is still done and done very well with high skill, you know, what impact, what's the negative impact of pulling teeth out? That's all, just, you know. And let me tell you, it was just a, but I think it's changed the way the public think about orthodontics, right? For good or bad, you know. And I think to this day, I get people to come in now and they don't even remember it was me on 60 Minutes, but they say things like, when I was a kid growing up, I remember watching this guy on 60 Minutes and he said not to take teeth out. And then he said, so when my kid was needing braces, I knew I'd, try and find someone. And then I said, mate, that was me, It's really weird. It's really weird.
Yeah, massive influence. I know of a surgeon who would then refer to his orthodontist because they were inclined not to take teeth out when he had cases that he didn't think the teeth should come out. There's a sentiment of that. It takes courage to go against the flow like that. Did that affect you, mentally, or you know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking burnout. I'm thinking, you know, dentistry is a tough thing. And then when you've got your peers saying, no, that's not right, when you truly think it's right and there's evidence for it now, how did that make you feel?
Yeah, look, it was the 1 year after 60 Minutes, even though, like, oh my God, I'm not kidding. I remember I only had two practices back then. And I remember my staff literally for 2 months, the phone would ring, they'd answer a call, it'd ring again. I actually referred out over 10,000 patients because I just couldn't cope, just to give you an idea how huge that was, right? And you speak to people like my mate Jeff Hall in Melbourne. So I had colleagues still who did what I did, and they just got busy overnight. I sent all my, because I got, 60 Minutes was national, remember? It was Australia-wide. So I was getting parents ringing from Brisbane and willing to travel to Sydney. And I said, this is ridiculous. No way. Go and see Peter Agnew in Brisbane. Go Paul in Melbourne. Go and see. So, you know, I actually, and a lot of those people years later just took the opportunity to say, thank you so much, Dr. Mahoney, for recommending Peter in Brisbane. He didn't take teeth out and my kid got a great result. And it made me feel good. So as far as the public, I was like a hero. And for business, obviously, it made me the powerhouse we are today. But for my professional reputation amongst my peers, and then I thought, you know what, do I really want to be a member of this old boys club, right? And I said, you know, if you're going to have such a narrow-minded attitude, stuff you. So I resigned from the ADA, I resigned from the ASO, and I said, look, I don't really, what do you need those bodies for at the end of the day, right? And I developed my own following, and that was students who wanted to learn what I was offering. And that's just grown, like, you know, my mini residency, which is now a 3-year program, we sell out well in advance. And you see some of the feedback on DPR or talking to some of the young, they get enthused by it. They say, wow, I want to learn this stuff. And I guess I think they get enthused because I'm enthused about what I teach. I love it. I never liked dentistry. I nearly left the profession. I found my passion, my real passion, doing orthodontics and doing early treatment orthodontics. So that's what it came down to.
Yeah, for sure. Tell us a bit about EODO. The mini residency, it's 3 years. It's for general dentists. And what should people expect to get out of something like that?
Well, EODO started off as a part-time thing in my garage because of the number of people who wanted to learn orthodontics, and there was not much around. Now, remember, I got such a hard time from ADA for teaching general dentists and ASO. Now, look, there's about 17 orthodontic programs, right? So what does that tell you? Yeah. Anyway, what I had decided is I want to teach, And initially it was just like a very simple one-year program, but it was all theory. And then I found that after the theory, the doctors trying to incorporate what I taught them in their own practice were struggling. So I said, look, we've got to make this clinical. So, you know, by that stage, I had three practices and we were able to, you know, ferry the students amongst the three practices to get clinical observation, you know. And then I decided, look, I want to get some credibility for my courses. So I approached a couple of the, there's a place in the UK, what governs postgraduate education is a government thing. It's called EdEqual. And to get to EdEqual 7 gives you a diploma level. But to get to EdEqual 7, you need to have, you know, literature review. And I just took years and years of paperwork. But at the end of the day, I got EdEqual 7, which meant that my courses could be accredited through a UK university. But it had to be 3 years. And at the end of the day, I thought, you know what? 3 years is better. Why? Because if you're doing orthodontics, the average case is 18 months to 2 years. You're not really going to start that case until you get the diagnosis, which might take, you know, a year of learning. So I think the three-year program I offer now gives students very good clinical skills because they finish a lot of cases during the 3 years with someone holding their hand. And I think that's where we stand out. I'm not trying to push my own trumpet. There's lots of good courses out there. Yeah. But if you're going to do, any course, you need to have a practical component. Imagine if you did an implant course and all you did was theory lectures. Would that be a good course? You want to do an implant course where you place some implants and there's a surgeon next to you in case you go through the sinus and he can help you and you learn from that. You know what I mean? So I made a big clinical component off the program, and I think that's really where our numbers have shot up. And I'm very proud of my students. They have to do a lot of learning. There's assignments. It's quite a taught. So it's not a like show up and you breathe and I take your pulse and you get, you know, it's not a exactly. Yeah. So yeah. And I love teaching. My legacy. When I move on, if I have a lot of my ex-students who have now become instructors for me, they work for me part-time and they're going to be the future of EODO. So EODO is going from like, you know, backyard organization to fully fledged, 90 students per year, new intake every year. So at any one time, there's year one, year two, year three students, huge alumni. I think alumni now of graduated students is 1,900. We have full-time staff. We have an online presence. It's really grown to the degree where the first time ever I can tell you I could leave clinical practice tomorrow and still have a very good income, a very good full-time practice just teaching. You know what I mean? You're talking about young graduates. They need to have a plan B. Now, my plan B was teaching and an education platform. I don't think any dentist who's a new graduate should just assume that for the rest of their life they're going to be a dentist. And I think that's what we used to think. We used to think, right, this is the golden years, you know, we'll do well. But speak to people who, have been burnt out from dentistry. There's a lot of pressure, you know that. There's more and more patient complaints every year. There's more regulation every year. There's price cutting. There's more dentists. There's more corporate. Yeah, it's not the great profession. Maybe. Yeah.
Tell me what makes you say that. Is it that you feel, you know, it is a stressful profession? There's no doubt about that. Is it the climate of the dental industry at the moment? Is the future you see? Why do you think that people need a plan B? And what do you think about the future of dentistry?
I can't speak too much for dental dentistry, but the future of orthodontics is not looking good, right?
Mainly because of the AI and being able to direct to consumer and Smile Direct Club, et cetera. Yep.
Correct. Right. And that's just not the Australian experience. You're really seeing that in America as well, right? But for general dentistry, I mean, I speak to general dentists on a daily basis. They're my students, you know, they're my referring dentists. In some way, you know, I'm kind of in the dental field. I get invited to study club lectures and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's always doom and gloom talk. And the common things are, number one, dentists who had very successful practices, who had loyal patients. Now the patients say, you know what, I'm going to go to my preferred provider because there's no gap. I'm going to go to the corporate clinic because there's no gap. And, you know, even for complex stuff, I might go overseas and get my implants done and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know, have we outpriced our profession that it's not affordable to the average Aussie? I remember reading a statistic somewhere. Maybe it was, it said probably only 20% of Australians can afford dentistry in Australia. That's pretty sad, isn't it?
It is sad, and it's expensive. There's so many reasons for that. There are definitely a lot of pressures on the industry at the moment, and there have been for the last, you know, I've been hearing that in podcasts myself for the last 10 years. I want to make a point. I can hear your passion. I want to point out that Derek's sharing his time on a Sunday night, so he's clearly passionate about teaching, and I appreciate that so very much. Let's take a step back away from the industry and the ODO. Let's talk back again about ortho, thinking about graduates as well. Something I really want to ask you as an orthodontist, what do graduates miss? Why? When are they not forgetting, but not recognizing situations and forgetting to refer or missing the referral?
So I think the average dentist doesn't look at eruption of canine, and just a simple thing like an OPG between 7 and 9 gives you a 90% chance of preventing canine impaction, right? Yeah. The paper is Erickson and Curol, and something I love teaching. Because then it's just a light bulb moment happens. The other is airway. You look at these kids, you look at venous pooling, you look at their malon party index, you look at sculpting of their tongue, their tonsils. You know, a great guy for that is David McIntosh, who I think you've interviewed, right?
I just released a podcast with David. It's an excellent podcast. It's about 2 hours, so everyone should check that out, I think. He's got so much information.
David is as passionate about innards and throat and working dentists as I. And I don't know whether David brought this up, but the first time I met David, we were both speaking together in the Sunshine Coast, and it was organized by one of my previous students who wanted to bring the knowledge to, you know, that part of Queensland, you know. I'm not going to go to Queenslanders, but you know, I spoke very slowly so they could.
My wife's from the Sunshine Coast and she edits the podcast, Derek, so watch out.
Okay. But David said to me, the first thing he said to me when I met him, he said, you know, I've already been warned off by the local orthodontist not to speak to dentists about this and not to affiliate with you because I believe you're a pariah. And I said, mate, you can believe that or you can come have a beer with me and you can see what I have to say. He's become my best friend.
Yeah.
Right?
I think you're on the same page, that's for sure.
Exactly, because he's realized that the dentists are missing this. He realized years ago the medical doctors were not paying attention. And because he is with Brooke, a beautiful dentist, I think she's taught him a lot about the dental game. And he's a clever guy. He's put the two and two together. And he said, hey, dentists need to be aware of this. So it's great because it's what I'm talking about. It's airway. And who best to learn airway from but an ear, nose, and throat doctor? And fantastic stuff. So I think dentists should take some sort of course on learning how to pick up airway problems in kids, no doubt about it. Understand that kids who don't breathe properly also don't learn properly, also have hyperactivity problems. You know, I can quote you studies. The Ghazal study showed a drop of 10 IQ points per year that the kid's not treated. And who's the gatekeeper of the airway? It's the dentist. They are looking in the mouth. So that's such an important role, such an important role. I get letters to this day from parents saying, Dr. Mahoney, you may not remember me, but I just want to thank you because you were the only one who picked up the airway problem with my kid. He was diagnosed ADHD. He wasn't doing well at school. After what you did for him, he's now top of his class and he's got into uni. Thank you for giving me back a different kid. Now, you don't get letters like that for the root canal you did on the person, right? I'm not trying to, you know, as I said,
But that's right. We can do more. Like the root canal is really important. You can get an abscess. That's pretty painful. But at the same time, we can do more if we pick this up in growing people. And it's absolutely huge. There's so much information on that with David. Just while we're talking about it, with that, extraction cases can affect the airway. Can you just talk a bit about that?
Look, there's a bit of controversy in the literature, but I can show you a couple of papers. It's to do with the tongue space, okay? The more room you give the tongue, the more the tongue is going to be forward positioned to open up the airway. The more you hold the tongue in jail by retracting teeth, the more that's the basic thing. Having said that, it's very hard to find a good scientific paper that links pure extraction to airway. But there's lots of papers that lead tongue-tied to airway. So if you do the maths, what does tongue-tied do? And I can just tell you from my own experience, and I think David would agree with that. If you've got a young kid who's got no room for their tongue, you widen the palate and teach the kid to breathe through the nose and put the tongue on the palate, call it myofunctional therapy, etc. It really improves the airway.
So it actually has an impact on the nasal airway as well.
Yes. So I was banging in 60 minutes. I was banging on about the profile being damaged. I think now, whether you agree or disagree with the profile, what about the airway? You know, if you have a kid who's already snoring, who has no room for their teeth, pulling out teeth to make room gives you a short-term relief of the crowding. But the crowding is a symptom. It's not the real problem. The problem is the narrow palate. And then David's full on board with that. You know, so it's so good to have another specialist in the field with the literature. And David knows his literature.
I mean,
So he's got a PhD. It's good to talk to people who switched on like that. And David and I, since that, now that, I think that was 15 years ago I first met David, we've done so many courses together. We've done so many courses together and we just feed off each other. It's fantastic.
Yeah? Yeah, he's a great guy. Definitely worth a listen if you haven't already heard it. Are there exceptions to that rule?
Yeah, I extract when I have a kid who has macrodontia, a vertical grower. So don't think that if you listen to Mahoney, you drink the Kool-Aid. You drink the Kool-Aid and everyone becomes a non-extraction. Because if you really know Derek Mahoney, if you work for me or you're one of my students, you know that I extract for the face.
Yeah.
So, you know, we do this very simple test. You do a line from the chin to the lower lip.
Yeah.
And if that line is well ahead of the nose, that's probably an extraction, right? But I used to extract just for crowding. My classical Eastman training, 5 millimeters of crowding or more, you pulled out 40. End of story. Now I can treat cases of 12 millimeters of crowding non-extraction because a face needs more support. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
In the same way, this is the real weird paradigm shift. The cases I extract in now are actually the cases that don't have crowding. They're cases that are bidental protrusive. They're mainly Chinese kids that really have, yeah. So I still extract, but I extract to improve the profile, whereas I used to extract for crowding, and that's the whole deal. So my adage is...
Yeah, a fundamental difference.
Yeah, extract for the face, not for the space. That's one of the things you learn at EODL.
That's excellent. And I think it's really important people do hear that there are exceptions to what you're saying originally. You know, people do say, oh, you know, you're going about non-extraction cases, but we need to know that, you know, there are exceptions to these rules. They're just kind of general concepts and general concepts and rules. Talking again about young dentists and orthodontics, when should a young dentist or can a young dentist step into orthodontics and what should they do as their first couple of steps?
And any year after they graduate, I mean, it's not as though, I don't know, it's not as though you have to have 5 years under your belt as a general dentist. So that doesn't even make sense. It's a totally different field. It's really a totally different field. And it helps your general dentistry because it helps you pick up problems, you know what I mean? So I would say as soon as you graduate, of course, the big thing is the dollar, you know. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll do something crazy. You know, people leave millions of dollars to charity. Maybe one day I will offer free education to all dentists who want to learn for 3 years full time. And I won't have patients and all that just to give something back to the profession. Because here's the problem. I'm saying the year you graduate is when you should learn orthodontics or what to look at. However, what's the problem the year you graduate? You got no money.
Absolutely. So it's the hardest time. You should be doing all the CPD then and you'd got no money for it. So
Exactly. So here's the catch 22. So I find that most of my students are around about the 5-year level because of the finances. That's all. And maybe I will offer, seriously, like I give away, every year I give away $30,000 prize to a new graduate to learn ortho at my course free. Everything, the whole 3 years catered. Because that's me giving back to someone, but they have to really come up with a genuine reason. You know? So I don't know, last time we did it, we had 2,500 applicants all saying, I think I'm worthy, you know? And I think we picked some good. It's not just me. My five instructors and myself look at everything and say, look, I think then we narrow down the bundles into this and this, and then we pick the winner. And I feel really good about that. I feel this is great. And I, you know, I don't look, I think, as you probably know, I've been very successful in practice. I've been very successful in the ODO. I don't really need them. I don't need them. But if I can help one kid who was trained by one of my students who got a better quality outcome in life because of what I was taught, that I die a happy man. That's really what it comes down to.
That's right. And your passion comes through, especially when, you know, you can say, no, it's not about the money. It's actually a passion to teach. And that's why you're spending your Sunday night talking about it. So I think that's really awesome. I went to University of Sydney and you gave someone in my class that course among other courses as a prize. And that was really generous of you. So yeah, you're doing good things there, I think, for sure. Once graduates do step into, or let's say graduates, young dentists step into orthodontics, what mistakes do you see?
I see a lot of them only do one type of orthodontics. They do like an aligner course, and then they think that everyone can be treated with aligner. And they think that the computer is going to magically mimic what happens in real life. And then they get a rude shock when they realize that their ClinCheck is nothing like what really happens in the mouth. That's the biggest error. And look, us, Annalyn, she's going to be one of your things. What's the biggest area of complaint of GP ortho? It's aligner therapy. Why? Because patients have a high expectation. The dentist has low level of training. That's a recipe for disaster, right? So if you pick the right cases, so you don't want to pick class three cases as a new grad, right? But if you have the thing is, you need a mentor. You need someone to look at all your cases and say, hey, good case for you, not a good case for you. So you need someone to triage that, you know?
So what kind of cases are people looking for when they feel competent and have had done the training? What kind of cases should they start with?
Well, class one, obviously, crowded cases. Class two deep bite cases, then the class two high angle cases. And then when you really got a lot of experience, the class threes, which are maxillary problems. Stay well away from the class three mandibular problems because no one wants to treat, even I don't want to treat it. So if a specialist doesn't want those cases, why would you put your hand up as a dentist to do that? And one thing I do teach at EODO is not just what cases to treat. I tell you what cases not to treat, what cases to keep well away from. But how to do a proper referral to an orthodontist saying, hey, I'm a general dentist. I do limited orthodontics, but with diagnosis, I've realized this is a class three vertical grower. It's a kid. There's a lot of growth remaining. This is well beyond my scope. I'm handing it over to you. And, you know, that's why we become specialists. I really think I love the challenging cases. I'd love to get the class one crowded cases, but I don't because most of my referrers are my previous students and they take on. So, but no worries. I like a challenge and I get all the really tough cases. We've become good teaching cases. I know I'm passionate about talking and teaching, but I'm getting death stares from my partner here because we're supposed to go to a dinner. I've been lecturing all day.
All right. Dr. Derek Mahoney, he's a busy man. He had to run, but we had a lot to chat about. So we got him back on the podcast. He spent another evening with us. He shared his time to share his story, his tips for graduates. And I hope you are enjoying the podcast. Let's keep it going. All right, part two with Derek. Derek had to run. He's a busy man. I asked for an hour of his time the other night and I got exactly that. So he's been a gentleman and he's actually giving a little bit more time to us at Dental Head Start. So thanks for joining us again, Derek.
No problems. Pleasure to be here.
So it brings me to a point that actually it's quite relevant for me is that, you know, you are a busy man and you do a lot with your time. You run EODO, you speak internationally. You run six very busy practices and see up to 250 patients a week. How do you manage your time? How do you do that?
I'm two benefits. One is I've always had this amazing ability of not needing to sleep for more than about 4 hours. I've done training in sleep medicine, and it's not as though I'm deprived of my sleep. I'm just one of those lucky individuals that can get into deep sleep, refreshing sleep, like straight away. And on that point, when I fly, I'm very productive on aircraft, probably get most of my work done. And again, have no problem sleeping, no jet lag, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think all those things have benefit. But I guess the main thing is the ability to learn how to delegate. In my first 5-6 years of practice, I think I just you know, want to be in control of everything, and no one could do anything as well as I could, and therefore I was left with all. And I think you learn the hard way that if you're going to grow in dentistry, the only way you can grow is by delegating. And I think one of the disadvantages a dentist has compared to a stockbroker or, you know, anyone who can do volumetric things without them being there is, you know, I remember, you know, my professor at ortho school telling me, look, you know, this is a gifted profession, but you'll never really be super rich because there's only you, there's only one pair of hands. But I think you can have that mentality, but you can also have the mentality, well, hey, if I can replicate a model that works and teach people to follow that model, then yeah, you can expand, you can get better. And if something happens to me with my health, or I just had enough one day, you know, the extension plan is still there. And I remember having a long discussion with John Kidd, who was the previous dental legal advisor for DPL. And he said, you know, one thing about being an orthodontist, it's really hard to retire, and it's actually dangerous to retire without having someone look after your patients, because what will happen, orthodontic patients, of course, will want their treatment continued to the same standard they're used to, and the moment they don't get access to that, then they feel like they've been deprived and they're unhappy. And, you know, I've seen it happen. I'm not mentioning names, but just recently a colleague of mine passed away, had no ascension plan. Some colleagues are kind of helping out finished patients in his practice, but the vast majority have gone elsewhere. And unfortunately, I hate to say this about my profession, but I mean, there's many orthodontists love putting the knife in to other orthodontists, you know. And so you imagine these patients, they're already upset. It's been 6 weeks since they've had their wire change. They now have to face new records, a new treatment plan. And on top of that, the last thing they want to hear is, oh, my God, all the stuff you've had done is a waste of time. We have to redo it again. It's going to cost you so much. You know, no wonder that it's a huge minefield. So, yeah, that's maybe getting off topic, but I think that's important for people to learn. Yeah,
yeah, it's definitely something to think about. We care for our patients long term, and if we're embarking on something like orthodontics, we have to think for the future. You actually bring up a good point. And of course, you know, passing away, that's a tragic story, or perhaps retiring, anything like that. But we're, as this aims at associates, we're often in someone else's practice. And, you know, as an associate, you're not tied in the same way you are if your own. So if you're starting orthodontics, you have to think about that stuff. So I think you bring up a really good point. You have to plan for the future and, well, be there for your patients. That's so important. You talk about, you know, we trade time for money, essentially, as dentists, and delegation, or I guess that can help with efficiencies. Any tips you can think of, or things that with delegation, perhaps not so much business, but clinical, that you can think of that would help graduates?
Well, look, I always remember for years and years, everyone in the dental fraternity, particularly, you know, the people running ADA, et cetera, were always moaning about how hard it was to retain staff, you know. But when they're talking about staff, they're talking about nurses and receptionists. But when you think about it, back in the day, your staff could really do not a lot. Like, you know, your definition of a dental nurse, you suck spit and mix alginate, you know. So who would want that profession for longer than, you know, a year or so? So I think the big tip is delegate within, obviously, scope of practice and legality, stuff that your staff can do and incites them. And that's what I do. I try empower all my staff. And I mean, I've been lucky in the last 5 years, I've had a mentality where anyone who works for me in the mouth obviously has to be registered with APRA, has to have done my 3 years course, et cetera. But anyone else, the assistants, the receptionists, all of them in my practice are overseas dentists. They're dentists who are doing the ADC, they're dentists who maybe don't want to go back to dentistry, but at the end of the day, they've all done a dental degree. And you'd be amazing how good it is then, because, I don't know, you've all had that receptionist who literally just answers the call and comes in clinically and asks you the same question, has no ability to think for herself or answer. Imagine having a dentist answering the phone for you, or a dentist being a treatment coordinator. You know, probably 90% of the questions you guess ask every day can be answered really well without the stress that you have. So one tip, if you can find them, find a good overseas trained dentist. And then the hard thing is there's many of them, but the ones who speak English really well are the difficult ones to find, you know?
I've actually worked with a nurse who was overseas trained dentist when I was nursing or dental assistant. And yeah, she was amazing. And she made the practice run and she was an absolute asset. Of course, because she was so good, she then passed ADC and now she's a dentist. Good for her. I'm sure you've experienced that as well.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you have them for 2 years, maybe three if you're lucky, but those are the two or three best years you have. And for me, how can I put it? When someone becomes a dentist, they enter a fraternity, a profession that they don't want to leave. When someone applies for a reception job and they've just come from HSC or they're in between whatever they want to do, it's not a career for them, unfortunately, not in this country. I mean, I go to America, I wish I could cut and paste and import every American staff member I'd seen. There's something about America, the nurses, the receptionists, they get paid minimal wages, you wouldn't get people to work for what they get paid there, but they're so loyal to their doctor. They're so loyal to the practice and they view it as a career. It's a different mentality here. I mean, so having good staff that you can trust to delegate, both clinically and non-clinically, is the secret. And I think if you're starting out, you got to the stage where it was just you and one nurse, and maybe your partner was the receptionist. You know, that's how I started out. Then the next person you're going to employ, maybe go through what's successful. Speak to I don't know whether you've had the opportunity to ever speak to Harry Margot down from Melbourne, but yeah, he should be on your list because he's got such experience in HR management. You've got Nav, who's got all those practices in. I love listening to their comments. I love listening to them because I learn. I mean, I'm successful, but no one's that successful. They won't learn that one little point from someone else. So I think a young graduate, look at guys who've really pushed the limit beyond the whole, well, I just have one practice and I work a couple of days a week and blah, 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 into people who run a business out of dentistry. I think that's important.
Absolutely. And that's obviously a big part of this podcast. We chatted with Nov, I think it's episode 3 and 4 perhaps. So absolute gentleman. He's got a lot of information. People should definitely listen to that one. Your point.
And willing to share it as well. To share it. That's the big thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. He spent an hour and a half or 2 hours with me. That's why it's two parts. You make a good point. Giving your nurses purpose and letting them evolve and get better at what they do keeps them around. It keeps them happy. I think for many students and graduates, I've really realized that I find if I've got purpose in what I'm learning, then I'm more engaged as well. So I think that works for everyone, really. You talked earlier on, you talked about a plan B and you talked about your own plan B. It's obviously teaching. You've been successful in that as well. What do you mean by that? And what's the point you like to get across there?
If you only have all your eggs in one basket, i.e. I'm a dentist and this is what I do, then anytime the economy is hit with optional things, and, we've seen that lately, then, the first people are going to be suffer are the dentists. So, could you have something else as a plan B? I know my good friend Glenn Willie, he was a musician and he did dentistry did it well, did great implants, but then he had a plan B when he decided to sell his practice or retire. You'd be amazed how many people I meet who have retired can't maintain the lifestyle that they've had as a dentist, have had nothing else to do, so kind of get bored and either go back into dentistry or go back begrudgingly to work because they need to work. I think one thing we're not taught at dental school is business management and how to plan for the future. And, just simple things like, as soon as you've got enough money behind you, own your own building, because at the end of the day, when you sell your business, that's X number of dollars, but being the landlord of a fully kitted out building that's in a location that people know it's there, that's golden, I know I own all six of my buildings and one day I may sell to an associate or not, but at the end of the day, I've still got that passive income stream, not relying on the business model. So just tips like that people should be taught.
Yeah, financial management, personal financial management, as well as business, is something obviously we get no education on. And then we get into this job where we earn fairly good money and then end up having a lavish lifestyle and no assets. So that's something I think people should learn and teach themselves on for sure, get a good accountant and all the rest of it. Great points. Let's change topic a little bit. We're back to a bit of orthodontics. I know a lot of people, obviously, we know you for your orthodontics and your teaching. And we had a question on Instagram. It's a really good question, I think. What are your thoughts on general dentists doing interceptive orthodontics?
Yeah, I mean, who else will do the interceptive orthodontics? Because the general dentist is the guy or the girl, sorry, who sees the patient at the right age. So
do you want them referred to you? Or like, as in what I'm saying, I guess, is do you think interceptive orthodontics in the wrong hands could be a mistake as well? And where do we draw the line?
I guess we've got to come up with the definitions here, okay? The variable you have with interceptive orthodontics is facial growth. Now, if you have a good grounding in understanding facial growth, you'll know what cases you won't start early. No one wants to start a class 3 that's got a genetic mandible that's just going to kickstart at 18. You're not going to get any benefit from doing interceptive there. But the kid who's got nasal obstruction, who has a narrow palate, who can't breathe, who snores at night, I mean, of course, the dentists are the gatekeepers of the airway. So definitely I don't encourage just sort of look, pick this and this is what you need to look for and then just refer it all to me. I mean, there's no way I as one individual or even as large as my organization is can keep up with the demand that's there. So I think a general dentist who has good basis and sounding in facial growth and development is the ideal person to sort of pick which cases to start. But I guess things have changed. Look, when I graduated from dental school, I had one lecture in orthodontics, okay, one lecture in the whole 5 years. And that lecture was pretty much along the lines of, you know, refer everything to an orthodontist, otherwise you go to hell. And seriously, it was angle classification and, you know, you need to refer this out, that out, that out. Right? So what do you think is the first thing I wanted to learn when I graduated? I wanted to learn something new that was exciting. And what do you think every parent asks a new graduate about their kids? It's not about whether they have fissure sealants. It's about, well, listen, my kid's got crowded teeth where I can see my kids, blah, blah, blah. So I think dentists are the best people to get involved in interceptive treatment, but you can't do that with a two-day course. And that's the point I was making to you earlier. I mean, I'm very proud of my graduates. They do literature review. They do problem-based learning exercises. And even when they finish their 3 years with me, they still pass cases for diagnosis through their instructors who then give them, yep, you're fine with that, or no, just be watching that one, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, but then after a while, after 2-3 years of having someone holding your hand, of course you know what to treat and what not to treat. I think what you're possibly alluding to is you can't learn orthodontics as a weekend course, right? It's not – I mean, if you graduate and you're pretty proficient at endo, you're probably pretty proficient at crown and bridge and, you know, the basics of dentistry, but you're not proficient at orthodontics and you can go and do a two-day weekend course on a new technique in molar endo and probably pick it up quickly and get to it. But you can't just do a two-day course in ortho because your undergraduate level has been so poor. That's the thing.
Foundations aren't quite there. What about, and I'll put you on the spot here, and you may or may not have an answer to this, but talking about courses, obviously you run yours, EODO, 3-year course, it's comprehensive, it sounds, you know, quite good. What about someone who's not actually looking to do any ortho, but wants to learn a lot more about exactly when to intervene or refer or to, you know, these key things, we're the gatekeeper. But I think, and I feel this way about my education, which I think was pretty good, but at the same time, I don't know exactly where that gate is or when they've entered that gate. Any courses or references or books or anything you can suggest for that kind of dentist?
Yeah, look, what happens with all courses, and I'm not just talking about mine, but every course, the first or second module, always is about diagnosis and treatment planning, right? So what I find is I get a lot of dentists who actually apply for my course and say, hey, I'm so busy with what I do, but I'd just like to learn a little bit more about airway, about what to look for. And they come along and pretty much do the first two modules, which is all just diagnosis, right? And they leave really happy. And I'm happy with that. It's up to the dentist if they want to go further. But as far as one particular textbook, I don't think there's one ideal book. But what I would recommend is Contemporary Orthodontics by Bill Proffitt. It's the Bible in orthodontics, and I think it's a very good reference source for that. There's also a couple of very good pediatric dental airway books, the best one I could suggest would be by Dr. David Ghazal. And, you know, these are good books depending on what you're looking for. But I guess the other good thing is if you can, if you have the orthodontist who's willing to share his time, now, spend a day a month or a day a fortnight or a day a week, depending on what's about, and shoulder someone who's doing this regularly. And you'd be amazing how much you learn that way.
Yeah. Make the right connections. And a lot of people are out there to help and to, you know, they'll show you if you ask the right stuff and let them help you. That's great. So speaking about, you know, advice and things like that, we talked briefly about it before, but I want to know a bit more about what mistakes you see younger dentists. And when I say younger, I often mean just inexperienced in orthodontics, the mistakes they're making, the things you're seeing in your clinic where they can get themselves into hot water. You mentioned class threes, that's fairly obvious and something we shouldn't be taking on. And then, of course, just doing one type of orthodontics, perhaps they're just doing clear aligners of a certain kind. Is there other things they're overseeing? Or other things that you see regularly as a mistake?
Look, let's go through all the medical legal cases I get asked to help in and give expert testimony to. The common thread is always poor records, incorrect diagnosis, and failure to manage the case appropriately. Or the big one is, even though you started the case when things are going belly up, when you should have appropriately refer that patient for a specialist opinion, you know? So these are the things that they look at. I would suggest that the cases that most people get into trouble with orthodontically are adults that have very thin gingival biotype. So you start moving teeth and then you get recession out of nowhere, even though they don't have active periodontal disease. So, you know, I always have a philosophy that if you see an older individual, you know, don't just assume the teeth are going to move like a child. And, you know, I always get a periodontal opinion on these patients. And sometimes I myself, after 30 years of experience, you know, think, oh, geez, I'm glad I got that opinion. I would have missed that. And I'm glad I didn't start moving that tooth because that gum would have just receded. So that's one thing. The other thing relates to what's called vertical growth. So you can get certain individuals who are what we call dolichofacial, who no matter what you do, they are programmed for their mandible to grow backward. So they end up with these skeletal open bites. And it can be quite harrowing when you start their treatment and it looks like it's a simple case. And then by the time you finish aligning their teeth, they've got this massive skeletal open bite problem. And I'm not talking about just general dentists. I mean, orthodontists dread those patients as well because, unfortunately, there's not a lot you can do to change that, right? I guess where I'm seeing a lot more complaints made, definitely clear aligner therapy for the general dentist. And normally it's the general dentist who doesn't know how to get himself out of trouble when the aligners are not tracking. All he knows how to do is to rescan and get a reaffinement. Whereas, you know, someone who has some orthodontic knowledge will say, hey, let's put a hold on the aligners at the moment. Let's cut a hole here, put a button there, run an elastic there, catch up, and then continue aligners. So that's a big one. The second one, I'm seeing a lot of dramas with release of lip and tongue ties, you know, and particularly in like neonates. I think that's something you've really got to be a bit careful and wary about, right?
Medico-legal cases are coming up with that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Mm. We talked briefly about that with David McIntosh in the previous podcast, and he makes a point about that in a way as well. I guess it's all about training. It's all about understanding whether you feel it's in your scope. Again, not something we're taught at dental school, I don't think. So aligner therapy, often general dentists get into orthodontics through aligner therapy. What are your general thoughts about aligner therapy just in general? Do you use it? Is it good?
I do, and it works. And it works if you properly treatment plan the case, and that's what it comes down to. You can't expect a lab technician on the other side of the world to be able to do your diagnosis and treatment planning. And many people get excited when they look at, I'll use the generic term ClinCheck, but, you know, that's Invisalign's version, but there's others. You know, obviously teeth move really well on a computer and it looks amazing. And the patient gets excited and they go, oh, my God, I always wanted teeth like that. But in real terms, in reality, you know, softwares aren't designed to replace clinical knowledge. And, you know, I have a good mate of mine. He's in Valencia, and he has an exclusive clear aligner practice. And when I say exclusive, I mean every case he does is clear aligner. He does it in kids, he does it in teenagers, he does it in adults, and his results are amazing. And, you know, I've gone and hung out with him for a week, and I said, like, how does this guy do this? And what it is, he spends up to an hour on every ClinCheck, modifying it. You know, he says, look, when you send something to any of the big companies, what you get back is really a pipe dream. And he's come up with certain protocols that you can apply. Like, I'll give you an example. We talked about open bites. One thing aligners are really bad at doing is extruding teeth, okay? So if you have a ClinCheck that shows a 5 millimeter open bite, and the teeth miraculously touch it, the last aligner, you know, you keep dreaming. It's actually not going to happen. But that's not to say that aligners don't work. If you have some nous to put some anchor points near the molars, what we call TADs, and then you put the right posterior attachments and you intrude the molars, which is effective and does work, you'll close that open bite with stability and with aligner. So that's just a little example of what I'm sort of saying at, you know. And aligners are really good at just dumping teeth forward. Whereas if you understand how to put the right attachments for torque, you can control that dumping, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it needs to be where if you're going to get into aligners, you really need to have someone who's very senior to you looking at your proposed ClinCheck, modifying it with you, and being able there to help you as you finish the case. I think that's really important. Whereas, you know, what's happening at the moment, it's so easy to certify in company X, Y, and B. And then next thing, you know, you're looking at every patient as a possible alignment case. And, you know, that may or may not be beneficial. And then there's all those, there's a lot of adults who, of course, need some minor aligner therapy before they hop into prosthetic work, whether it's bridge work or veneers. And, you know, and again, limited movement is what aligners are great for. But if you want to try to promise someone the world and, you know, shut down a 5 millimeter open bite on a class 2 with no mandible using aligners, well, you know, good luck with that. That's where the problem's going to arise, because the patients are going to get despondent because, you know, you've promised them X and you delivered well below X. And next thing they're going to say, well, hang on a minute, I'm going for a second opinion. And hold your hats. If you're a general dentist and things go wrong and your patient goes to a specialist who doesn't really like general dentists doing ortho, wow, sit back and watch the popcorn unfold for that one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's and that's, I guess, every general dentist fear. That's a really good point. We need to understand what we're doing and recognize that aligners are not as simple as the ClinCheck or, you know, whatever makes it look. So thanks for that advice. I think people will hear that, and that's great. It resonates with me as well. Just wrapping up, I'd like to ask a few questions, and they're to you, and I want you to think back to, you know, when you graduated, you came out, you're a little bit despondent with dentistry, went traveling. What advice, now that you're in this position, you can literally get in your own ear when you graduated, what advice would you have given yourself to perhaps get to you where you are faster or change your path then?
That's a tough one, isn't it?
Or are you happy?
Faster. Yeah. I believe in karma, and I just think, you know, meeting who I did, you know, an ortho resident when I was despondent with dentistry, and then realize, hang on, you don't just have to be a dentist. Maybe you could do this stuff, right? I was in the right place at the right time. Well, what can I say? I mean, had it not been for that, I probably would have not have even been in a dental career. Whether I'd been as successful as I am now, maybe, I don't know. You know, would I have been as happy as I am now? Maybe. I don't know. It's a hard one. I just could never see me being, you know, the drill, fill, and bill type dentist. It wasn't exciting for me. My teachers I had were literally another nail in the coffin to put the lack of excitement into the deal, seriously, you know. So, yeah, just happened to find a person who was so enthused by what she was studying and how different it was to what I was exposed to in dental school that I thought, yeah, I'll give this a go. And I gave it a go and I just found my passion. So, yeah, so I think if there's, you know, sometimes I see on DPR, you know, people, young dentists, you know, they things are going well, then all of a sudden they get their first complaint, you know, and they really take it personally. Like I did everything for that patient and then, you know, they went and wrote to dental council about me or HCCC. Well, you know, and then they kind of question, oh, well, you know, I work so hard and you know, if this is what life's going to be, this is really worth it. I've seen those sort of posts, right? And I think dentistry has its ups and downs and you need peer support. You need that senior person that you can get on the phone to and say, look, I've had a shit day. This is what's happened. And they're going to say, well, look, you'll laugh about this a month from now, blah, blah, blah. But if you don't have that peer support, yeah, it can be quite frightening. And yeah.
That's a really good point. I guess I'll ask you the question, but I'll say it first. I've had a patient that I really did try to do everything for, and they went to I think it was HCCC, made a complaint. It was completely frivolous, but at the same time, yeah, it affects you. I don't know. Have you ever had a complaint? How do you suggest people deal with that? Apart from you know talking to that senior person, is there anything else?
Well, once you get a complaint through HCCC, unfortunately, it opens up a can of worms. Why? HCCC doesn't have a dentist on its staff. So what do? They'll flick everything to dental council. So you write all these reports with all these records. You send them to body A. They'll say, all right, we're flicking this to council. Then you got to write the whole thing again and blah, 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 right? And at the end of the day, it's over minor matters. The last complaint I had against me, believe it or not, was someone who wanted their money back for records because they didn't realize they had to pay for records and they thought it was all included in the consultation. Can you believe that? Yeah. Now, normally, you know, a good governing body would look at that and they'd throw it out as a waste of judicial time and effort. But no, you're dealing with public servants here who are absolutely – my persevere, I'll just say it outright, who, you know, absolutely don't have any gray area, right? And so for those who've ever been through that harrowing experience, the time you spend, you know, writing those reports and showing up for this hearing, you must be off just writing the check and give to the patient. I know that sounds unfair and I know it sounds like you feel like hard done by, but in the real world, it's a business decision.
Right?
Yeah.
That's true, isn't it? That's absolutely true. And to be honest, that's the advice you often get from your insurance as well, which is for good reason, I think. Look, I want to ask another question. You were talking about perhaps you might not even be in dentistry. What would you do if you weren't a dentist?
Me, I definitely winemaking. I mean, I own a vineyard and I initially bought the vineyard as a total tax not Dodge, that's not the right word, is it?
Not on a public podcast.
A total way of minimizing my tax. I've always loved drinking wine, of course. I think which dentist doesn't? But then when I realized that a lot of effort goes into wine making and, you know, it sparked my intellect. And so, yeah, my plan B, if I wasn't doing anything with orthodontics and I wasn't lecturing in orthodontics, I'd be trying to produce the best quality wine I could, you know.
What varietal?
The hardest grape to grow and the most finical grape is Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir is like, you know, that best friend you have that is always a bit HM, right? You don't know what to expect. And it's been a learning curve for me, you know, starting with a small vineyard, not having the money the big boys have to, you know, when the temperature's about to drop below freezing, the big boys have their own helicopters that churn the air, you know. So you've had to think outside the box. I think, shit, I can't afford that. What can I do? And so, you know, you rig up a watering system that's connected to the hot water supply. So then you spray warm water and does the same job, but one millionth of the cost, you know. I had no idea how expensive a bloody French oak barrel. When you age a wine in French oak, you have any idea how much a good quality French oak barrel costs?
I like wine too. I could be wrong, but they're a couple of grand at least, aren't they?
A good one, we're looking at about 9,000 euro.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Euro, okay.
Yeah, euro. And then you get about three vintages out of that, you know. So again, you can spend so much money, but it's kind of rewarding when you taste the fruits of your labor. And but we've done well with the vineyard. But to me, it's my relaxation. It's my ability to switch off. Lucky where my vineyard is, there's no wireless internet. Can you believe that? So it forces me, and it's really relaxing, you know. Because, there's the only time I can really switch off. So that would be my plan B. But my real plan B, which is going to happen, is when I've sold my practices to my associates. You know, the service will still continue. The what we do will still continue, and I can then focus on what I really enjoy, which is teaching, and I love teaching and traveling. And I mean, what greater life could you have? Every year, I turn back about 15 invitations to lecture because I just haven't got the time. You know, in the UN, there's 192 countries. Two are not recognized, which is the Vatican and Palestine. Now, of those 190 countries that are recognized, I have a goal. I want to lecture in every country. So I'm up to 122.
That's amazing.
And what other profession where someone will pay you your airfare, your accommodation, and, you know, if you're lucky, an honorarium as well, to see a new country, experience a new culture, meet. And the good thing about orthodontics, whether, you know, you're an orthodontist in Kabul or in Dunedin, you know, we face very similar problems. And so you learn so much in traveling. So my real plan B is actually to do less clinical, more teaching. But, you know, I still have to do clinical because you can't effectively be a good teacher if you're not trying new products and you're not seeing what works and what doesn't. But maybe do that more, you know, from a delegation point of view of good associates who've worked for me for 10, 15 years who are now willing to take the next step. Because every good associate after a certain time is going to either want to open their own practice or not. And, you know, I think many people regret that they let that 10-year associate go. And now they don't have anyone who'd be interested in buying the practice. So that's you know the sort of thing I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's really good. And I think one of some of the parts are that you've got business that then functions as a business, not just yourself within the business. And a lot of people, you know, Jesse Green and other people who do podcasts and things around that. I've learned a lot from that. It's pretty interesting. Can I ask where is it a cool climate for region where your vineyard is?
yeah, it's Central Otago.
Central Otago. Beautiful.
And I still believe that region of the world produces some of the best Pinots there is. I mean, I'll share a joke with you. Not a joke, I mean, a real thing that happened. So my winemaker, I won't mention his name or anything, but he was my mate in school, you know. And when I got into dentistry, he got into chemical engineering, you know. So he did really well, and then unfortunately he started making ecstasy tablets, you know. And he did really well. I mean, you know, if you ever watched that movie Wolf on Wall Street, that was that guy, right? Unfortunately, you know, or fortunately, or whatever you want to enjoy, you look at the long arm of the law caught up with him, and he spent many years in prison, right? Now guess what he learned in prison. He learned viticulture because it was always his hobby.
Fair enough.
You can do it via distance learning. I didn't realize that. So
Forced to sit down and focus.
Exactly, yeah. So he comes out of jail, and obviously it's not too easy to get a job in his previous career. This is about the time I was just selling my grapes. It was, you know, actually it was purely just a tax thing. And then I realized, hang on, maybe I can put two together. And this guy's so brilliant because with his chemistry background, what people don't realize is what makes a really good vintage is the mold that you find on the grape, right? And if you're a good chemist, you can mimic that mold in the laboratory, right? So the French love Burgundy, and they believe that unless Pinot is grown in Burgundy, it's not a real Pinot Noir. You know, you know what the French are like, right? So my wine was actually nominated for an award for Young Winemaker. And of course, my mate couldn't go because he's got certain travel restrictions.
Oh, yes. Yep.
So I went along. And oh my God, it was an amazing experience because you know you're in Bordeaux. So even though it was a wine tasting thing, I was nominated for the Pinot, and it's a blind tasting. So the good thing about blind tasting, no one can know where the wines come from, and that just shows you. You know, whereas when you get the French and they bang on about, well, this is vintage blah blah blah, and that was a good year, and you know, et cetera.
So punching above your weight by the sounds of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's 15 winemakers, and they all have to give a speech about their wine. And then the judges make their decision. Now, the problem is, A, I'm not a winemaker. I mean, I know a fair bit about it, but I have no clue that these guys are like fourth, fifth generation bloody winemakers. And B, I drew number 15 to give the speech, right? So here am I, great wine, bit nervous. So what do? I'm drinking everyone's drink. And luckily, number 14 was this big French guy, and he just bored everyone. You know, chateau, and he banged on for about half an hour. Everyone was off there. You know, I got up. I was a bit tanked, and I said, "Look, I'm new, but try my Pinot. It'll knock your tits off." And I just sat down, and I got a standing ovation. People actually gave me a standing ovation. And I think that's why my wine won a medal.
Yeah. Yeah, the comedy's come back to help you out in that situation. Yeah. That's fantastic. I'll try that one day if it's on
the market. I'll send you one of our vintages out of the cast. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be pretty good. So the very last question, thank you so much for sharing some of that wine knowledge as well. That's really interesting, and I definitely enjoy a good Pinot myself. I want you to think about all the graduates that are coming out right now. So they're actually about to graduate pretty soon. They're about to do their exams. And if you can tell them and teach them one thing that you think will help them for the future, it can be orthodontics, it can be about business, life, whatever. What's the one thing you would want to teach all of the graduates?
To me, airway. And how so many things you see in the mouth are related to poor nasal breathing, right? So bruxism, you know, that's something they'll come across. Erosive lesions, dry mouth, you know, high caries rate. Of course, the classic, which is snoring sleep apnea. So unfortunately, we don't get a good grounding in this in dental school. But the dentist, I really believe, is the gatekeeper of the airway. So if I was given just 1 hour to lecture to that group of students, you know, the new grads, that 1 hour would be spent not on orthodontics, not about, you know, how you stop thumb sucking or when you treat a class two. No, it'll be just the real basic stuff. How do you examine a kid from airway first and teeth last? And you'd be amazed how many things you pick up and how grateful the parents are that you pick this up and you help their kid do better at school, sleep better, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they will stay with you. I mean, everyone moans about, I have friends who are my vintage of dental school who say, oh, it's not the way it used to be. We ring people for their 6-monthly recalls and they say, look, we'll come to you if it's complex work, but at the end of the day, we're going to Health Fund X or No Gaps B, or because, you know, we're getting the maintenance stuff done so elsewhere. But, you know, if you save someone's kid from sleep apnea because you picked it up and no one else did, they will never leave you. And that's the message I'd like to say to people, you know. Start learning about the link between dental problems and mouth breathing, you know, facial growth and development, increased chance of caries, malocclusions, sleep apnea, you know, nocturnal enuresis, recurrent middle ear infection. You know, this is what I really like people to learn.
Yeah, and that's just wonderful advice. The more you learn about it, the more you realize this is critical and that we can actually change lives by picking it up. And as you've said a few times, talked about David McIntosh, his interview, we covered a lot of that as well. And it's just
great.
It's fundamental stuff. I really appreciate you sharing that. I so much appreciate you sharing all the time you have with us here. Thank you, Derek, for all of your time.
And congratulations on what you...
All right. That was a great episode with Dr. Derek Mahoney. Thank you, Derek, for sharing your time in two separate segments with us on the Dental Head Start podcast. Now, we've got the Prime Head Start segment. This is with Patrick Moberger. We're talking about three mistakes dentists unwittingly make. Welcome to the Prime Head Start segment, proudly brought to you by Prime Practice. This episode, we've got Patrick Moberger with us. Patrick is the General Manager for Training and Development with Prime Practice. How are you this evening, Patrick?
I'm really, really well. I've had a good day today, so I'm ready for having a podcast with you, David.
Well, I'm pretty excited to have this chat, actually, because this, obviously, I've always said communication is very important, and we're talking today about communication, but we're actually going to talk a little bit about some of the mistakes people make with communication. What are some of the mistakes you see dentists unwittingly make?
And I think that you just nailed it right there, David, because it's mistakes that dentists unknowingly make. They're actually not aware of them making them. The only thing that happens when they have a patient in their chair, especially in a new patient exam, is that they think that they're doing everything right. And then the patient leaves and saying, I'll think about that. Mm. And the dentist gets really confused because they think that they've done everything right. So I've listed three common mistakes, and I might step on people's toes, and I'm really sorry if I'm doing that. But it might shine a light on some of the mistakes and make some people feel like, oh, I'm making those mistakes. I should actually do something about that.
One of my favorite sayings is you don't know what you don't know. So I think it's good that you actually highlighted in that way. It makes us think about this thing. Okay, take a step back, think about what you do say. So what are some of these mistakes?
And don't worry, I will give some tips as well on how to get around those ones. I'm not just going to focus on the problems. One of the first mistakes that I see a lot is dentists being too much of a dentist. Mm. And that sounds a little bit weird, but when dentists are using their IQ instead of their EQ, so instead of using their emotional intelligence, they start to go too clinical a bit too early, especially in a new patient exam. If they have a new patient with them in the chair for the first time, they never met them before. Mm. The patient is checking out the dentist almost as if it was a first date. So they're checking each other out a little bit. And if you've had a bad first date where the other person is just talking about themselves too much, or they're starting to talk about things that are not really interesting for the conversation, it's a risk that you tune out quite quickly. And it's the same here with dentists in a new patient exam. If they go in and start talking too much about the clinical problems instead of getting to know the patient a little bit earlier, it's a risk here that the patient is tuning out. And they sit there, they smile, and they nod as if they understand. And the dentist think, yes, I got him. He understands exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So a couple of tips here. Instead of going too clinical too early, is to spend a little bit more time in the beginning of the new patient exam with a patient, listening a little bit more to the patient, taking the time to maybe ask a couple of questions about their lives, building some trust, and getting some information from the wealth of knowledge that the rest of the team has. So getting information from the front office, from the receptionist, getting information from the dental assistant, things that the patient might have said to the rest of the team, and then you can use to show that you actually know the patient a little bit already up front. Mm. This really helps the patient to feel like, oh, this is a nice dentist. That guy, David, I can trust him. He shows that he is knowing me a little bit and that he's just not about teeth. He's actually listening to me as a human being as well.
It shows a bit of communication within your practice as well. It shows you're a good team. I like that.
Yeah, I think
I like
so.
That a lot. Yeah.
And I think that one of the sayings that I heard a long time ago, which really taps into this one, is to be interesting, be interested. Mm.
Yeah, it's a fantastic one. Yeah.
Yeah, and that just shows that you have to slow down a little bit sometimes.
That's a great point.
The second mistake that I have on my list of mistakes is that many dentists focus too much on the solution. Mm. They have great before and after shots, and they talk a lot about solutions. Have I got a solution for you? And they go into the solution far too early. And the high risk here is that the patients start seeing the dentist as a sleazy salesperson. And that's the least thing the dentists want to be. I know that most dentists want to be ethical health professionals, and I hate feeling that I come across now as a salesperson. And the mistake that many dentists do is to start focusing on the solution too early instead of focusing on the problem instead. So start focusing more about on the problem. Let the patient truly understand what the problem that they might have in their mouth, even though they might not have any problems. They don't feel that they have any problems. It's been good for all these years, and they believe it's going to be good for the next 20 years as well. Mm. And it doesn't hurt, so it can't be a problem. But as a dentist, you know that that is not the truth always. So help the patient here to understand that there is a problem, and by just keep going like you've always been is not going to help you. And I know that for many dentists starting using intraoral and extraoral cameras, that has really become a great way of showing the patient that there is a problem.
Yeah,
and, fantastic and you mean,
tool.
Yeah, and I mean, you know as well as a professional that once the patient actually sees their own teeth for the first time on a digital image, not on an x-ray, their reaction is normally, ooh, that's horrible. And that's good. That's really, really good, because now they're deepening their own concerns. And now they've come to a position where they are asking for solutions instead of the dentist trying to push and recommend solutions far too early. Wait as long as you can with the solutions until you're 100% sure that the patient understands what the problem is, have seen the problem, and have articulated, I have a problem. Please, doctor, what can you do to help me? Now you're in the best position.
With the photos, sometimes they will even point and say, what do we do about that? What do we do about this? And they lead themselves down the path because they're actually seeing it for the first time. I love that, and I think photos are very important.
Yeah, and I think that when patients are leading you as a dentist down that path, give them a little bit of credit. When you ask them, can you see that fracture in the tooth that I spoke to Sally about when we looked around in the mouth? And the patient says, yeah, I can see that one. Is that the one there towards the tongue? Give them a little bit of credit for that. Yeah, that's exactly the one. That's great that you can see that. Not all patients can actually see it. So that's good that you can see it. Now you're making the patient feel good about themselves, that they see that they have problems.
Mm.
Psychologically, that's a really good space to be in for the patient.
Yeah, that's great. What's the third?
The third mistake is when dentists start to educate patients in the way that they were educated at university. You know, in a very scientific way, in a very academic way. And when that happens, the problem is that you have a patient who look up to you as a dentist. They have respect for you as a dentist, and they put dentists up on a pedestal a little bit. So when they have that view of the dentist, and they start using dental jargon and technical and scientific language, instead of saying, I don't understand what you're saying right now, the patient goes into nodding and saying, yep, I understand. And then when the dentist leaves the room and the DA is there alone with the patient, the first thing that the DA gets to hear is, what did he say? I didn't understand.
If they say it at all. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So using your DA to be the translator is good if you took too much dentalese. But I think that stop talking dentalese and speak the language that the patient understands, the more emotional language, using pictures, using metaphors, using stories that they can relate to, using photos like we just spoke about. Any of those things that help the patient understand in their language. But just remember that you need to relate them back to the patient. So say that you know from the front office that this patient is an engineer. Yeah? Now you know that if there is a problem with malocclusion, for example, now if you start talking about cogs, the engineer will understand that. So now you can use metaphors that this patient will understand better. So again, the more information that you can get from the front office about this patient, the better it is. And not only does it show that you're working as a team, but it really shows that you've done a little bit of homework to truly understand who this person is. And then you can become more strategic in your education as well, so that you get more succinct and right to the point where you want to be. Mm. I think that one of the biggest problems for dentists is that they talk too much.
It's something
just like I am right now.
Yeah, not at all. No, this is wonderful. But at the same time, I've definitely experienced that. You just talk and then you realize you're talking and then you're still talking and you think, wow. I think all of those points are so useful and so important. And I really thank you for sharing them with us, Patrick. Appreciate your time here on the Prime Head Start segment.
That's all right. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Patrick, for your information there. I think that's great stuff that we're going to be able to use and help us avoid making those mistakes. So thanks for your time. Don't forget to check out my collaboration with Dr. Omid Azami. It's Foresight Dental on Facebook and Instagram. We're doing the Foresight Live podcast, which is where we're doing 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes with someone who's been there, gone through the graduation stage. They're either high in their career or an early graduate, but we get a perspective on what they've done and how they got there. And you'll find out more about the journal we're about to release, which gives you clarity and focus and perspective early in your dental career. Thank you for listening to everyone out there. Check us out at Dental Head Start on Facebook and Instagram. We love hearing your feedback. If you enjoy this, let us know. If you like it, share it with a friend. That'll give dental hygiene to someone in need. And thank you for listening. You're giving water to someone in need. All right, that's enough from me. I can't wait for the next episode. We'll see you in 2 weeks.